This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Following a Thai crackdown on human trafficking, the UNHCR said last week several thousand migrants were abandoned at sea by smugglers. Many of the arrivals are Rohingyas, a stateless Muslim minority from Myanmar, described by the UN as one of the most persecuted minorities in the world. After being repeatedly turned away and left stranded at sea for weeks, Malaysia, Indonesia and Thailand finally came to a temporary solution to shelter them for 1 year. In the studio with me to discuss the politics behind this humanitarian crisis are Dr. Gerhard Hofstetter, an anthropologist at the University of Queensland who researches refugee and immigration policy, and Sumitra Viswanathan, spokesperson for Migration Working Group. Gerhard, in an op-ed that you wrote for The Conversation, you emphasized the need to differentiate between the Bangladeshi and Rohingyas on the boats. Tell us why and how these two groups should be treated differently.
Well, I was drawing attention to the nature of irregular migration in the region, and that it's not just about one group. In fact, there are lots of different mixed migratory flows in the region. We need a regional approach to all those migration movements, and not just one focused on what is usually termed human trafficking. That's one that is often focused on penalizing, especially the people who are the victims, and you know, militarizing, stopping boats, and focusing on national policies and national interests rather than taking into account the broader picture.
The issue of refugees has been happening on and off for many years now. Why did it flare up again at this moment in time? You know, what's the underlying reason?
I think it didn't really flare up at this moment in time. I think it, the flare up is in the media. People have been on this specific migratory route. People have been coming for over 20 years, especially Rohingyas have been coming for over 20 years to Malaysia. So that's not a new thing. I think the flare-up is that now it's actually made the media, and people have taken an interest, and people have sensationalized it to some degree. And that was really a reaction to the camps that were found quite recently in southern Thailand, and the Thai government's decision to start a crackdown. Now, the Thai Navy had been pushing back boats for quite a while, and that hadn't really been in the news. It's been happening for a long time. This time, I think because there were lots of boats in the seas at any given time, and the Thai Navy and the Malaysians were included in that, and the Indonesian Navy were in effect blockading the boats, that brought international attention. But I think also the fact that both Europe and Australia have been experiencing similar issues around boat arrivals, it was an issue that was taken up by the media at this point in time.
Sumitra, perhaps you could tell us, why were people risking this journey, this whole process?
Well, with the people who are currently on the boats, just to maybe focus on the boats itself for a while, they are either fleeing extreme poverty in Bangladesh or they are Rohingya. And Rohingya, as we know, are people who have been facing extreme persecution in Bangladesh for many, many years. But just maybe to go back to something that was said earlier, why did it flare up suddenly? And yes, it has been an issue that's been highlighted by the media of late, but also it somehow brought visible something that has been occurring for a long time that has been invisible. So yeah.
That aspect of invisibility is one that interests me because I feel as if this issue kind of percolates underneath most of our consciousness. I think for most people, the name of these people, we're familiar with it, even if we don't fully understand their story. Why isn't it something that we know more about? Why isn't it something that has been made visible in the past?
Yeah. With so many refugee forced displacement into our country, it has been happening for a long time. We have a long history of migration going back to the very earliest times, recorded history in this peninsula. But the recent large forced displacement inflows into the peninsula have been the Vietnamese, have been the Cambodian, they've been the Achinese, also to East Malaysia, the Filipino Muslims into Sabah, and also Thai Muslims And so much of that response has been when you look at it in hindsight, so much of that response has actually been generally positive by our country, but as well, so much of that response has been under the radar. And I think it is an approach that has been taken by the government to not make it too visible. I think the time is actually now to change that approach and to actually make it visible, because what you ask is a very valid question. Why do people not know about this? Why do people not know that Rohingyas have been coming to our country since 1992? Why do people not know that Rohingyas are living in our country and providing labor trying to survive, fleeing persecution from Myanmar? And the persecution that they face is, in a way, the worst kind of persecution, because it's the denial of nationality. And the denial of nationality is the denial to have rights. So you have no rights at all as a citizen in your own country where you were born and where your forefathers were born. And that complete annihilation of the relationship between the individual Rohingya and the state of Myanmar has so much attached to it. It's the complete annihilation of them as people, and so they have no choice but to leave.
Can I butt in to answer your question from an outsider's point of view, a non-Malaysian point of view, perhaps? I think Malaysia is a very fascinating country to study, in part because I'm interested in identity. And identity politics in this country are fascinating, and they're often all-consuming. But they're usually identity politics between the three major ethnic groups and others, under which refugees and lots of other migrants fall, are outside of that discussion, outside of that debate. And so they don't receive the same attention, because people are often, I don't want to use the word obsessed, but now I've used it. Often quite obsessed with their own identity and how it fits into the political landscape in Malaysia. And so, you know, other migrants, refugees, asylum seekers, all these other groups don't get that same level of attention.
Having said that now, you know, there has been a certain level of outrage that's occurred over the situation. I think, you know, there have been a lot of evocative photos. There have been a lot of things that have been written about the situation of these people on the boats. And so what we've done now is offer a solution, which is to provide temporary shelters for 7,000 migrants for 1 year. Is this a satisfactory response?
Well, I would say it's good that this is being done, but it's simply not enough. It's not enough because it is a band-aid response to a situation that requires much, much more intervention, a more comprehensive solution. It's not enough because in my previous capacity of working with refugees in so many other situations around the globe, I have been involved in many, many emergency situations where people in need of international protection are placed in a situation where their lives are at immediate risk. An asylum country does not act quickly enough or does not wish to act. They then put pressure on the international community to step in and do something. So it's kind of like an eyeball-to-eyeball situation while people are at risk of dying. And then a response comes. The response comes with certain commitments, a commitment of resettlement, a commitment of funds, etc. And then there's always that famous time frame, you know, do it within 1 year, do it within 6 months, get them out of here within 3 months. And everyone says, because they're so motivated by the will to protect and preserve life, it's yes, yes, we'll do it, we'll do it. But the reality is something like resettlement is a very, very complex process. It has to be, it comes after an even more complex process of status determination, which is very detailed, very analytical, very time consuming. It's a specialist legal procedure. And after having done that, and it's individualized, and after having gone through that, each individual is then submitted formally for resettlement to another country that, again, takes up quite a lot of time. To be able to do all of that for 8,000, up to 8,000 people in 1 year is, I think, a bit optimistic.
I think there have been lots of cases where there's been mass identification. So if you belong to a certain ethnic group, you can be
automatically assigned refugee status in a way?
It'll be a bit difficult if it is also tied to this issue of a resettlement, because resettlement is an individual process. The individual dossier needs to be presented to the resettlement country. They have their own processes as well for determining status and determining whether the person should be included in their country. So it is a long process, and I think 1 year is perhaps a little bit unrealistic. I would say that the more important thing is to look at, again, a comprehensive regional framework, because we can extend protection and, you know, try to put something in place for this particular group. But the reality, again, and I think what's been said earlier as well by my colleague, is that this situation has been going on for a long time. There are people who are already in our country in a difficult situation who cannot return to their own country. And a comprehensive solution would not just help us respond to this group, it will also help us respond to those people who are already here in Malaysia.
And to put that in context, right now, as of right now, the UNHCR has already registered about 150,000 refugees, with another 25 people, persons of concern, and another, we don't know how many, thousands of asylum seekers who are not even in that process yet. So that the numbers are quite staggering. And I agree, a regional framework should be discussed. And that doesn't have to include the convention and, you know, in fact, Malaysia has been a host and has provided sanctuary to refugees without naming them as refugees previously. And that's certainly something that continues and can continue under different frameworks.
Mm. I'm speaking today with Dr. Gerhard Hofstetter, a senior research fellow at the University of Queensland, and Sumitra Viswanathan, spokesperson for the Migration Working Group. We are discussing the ongoing refugee crisis. I'd like to explore a little bit more about this notion, you know, of a regional framework, which will continue after this. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me in the studio today, Dr. Gerhard Hofstetter, Senior Research Fellow at the University of Queensland, and Sumitra Viswanathan, Spokesperson for Migration Working Group. And we are discussing the ongoing Rohingya refugee crisis. So before we left off, you were both discussing the need for a regional framework in order to deal with the larger repercussions of having so many stateless people more or less, you know, roaming the region. And what would this regional framework look like? You know, how would we encourage cooperation? How would we decide who takes responsibility for what?
Well, go ahead, Gerhard.
Sorry, a regional framework already exists. The Bali process since 2002 was established to deal with precisely this, irregular movements of people. Indonesia and Australia chair this process, and there's about 40 members now, which includes, you know, countries where outside of the region that are the source countries of a lot of irregular migrants, such as Afghanistan, Iraq, etc., but also so-called transit countries, to which Malaysia sort of belongs, although it's also a destination country for a lot of asylum seekers and irregular migrants. So there is a legal framework. The trouble has been, and also there's ASEAN, of course, as a regional body. The problem has really been enforcing and or coming up with an actionable plan, or, you know, a plan of action that actually has action following it. I mean, there have been lots of plans and declarations made. People, you know, foreign ministers have signed lots of documents, but nothing's actually happened. And I think that's the biggest problem, and overcoming that is, or I think one of the issues why that hasn't happened has been national interest that was largely opposed to actually dealing with this sort of transnational regional framework and implementing it. And hopefully this, you know, media attention, the attention ordinary people are now giving this topic, thinking about it, reflecting upon it, hopefully that will spur politicians into more action to actually implement some of those things that have already been decided upon.
Yeah, and I would agree. And also, there are so many other entry points and frameworks that are currently in place or in development from an aspirational point of view have been talked about, right? And, you know, there is the development framework as an entry point. There is the trafficking framework as an entry point. So it really is a question of, are the countries in the region, are all the ASEAN member states, able to come together to recognize the many dimensions and layers of this problem, which is essentially one of human security. And are we then able, as a regional body, able to respond to it in a way that is humane, in a way that meets international standards, and in a way that's going to further promote our development and promote and protect human rights in the region? That really is the question.
So in the past then and right now, why is helping or settling refugees such a politically unpopular and heated issue?
There is, you know, Gerhard also mentioned this issue of the other. There's always this sense of the other coming to my country and taking things away from me. But we need to move away from that. It's very important to move away from that. But moving public opinion away from that is challenging. I would say that, you know, let's look at the different concerns that have been expressed in the past. There is the concern of national security. There is the concern of influx. There is the concern of
finances.
A strain on the national pocket. There is the concern of importing foreign issues into your country. So maybe let's look at influx. Since the beginning of this year, 25,000 people have apparently boarded boats and left from that area in Bangladesh and made its way, and the boats have made their way to Thailand. That is the trafficking route. Bangladeshis, Rohingya, all kinds of people from that region, they bought the boats. And the standard thing is that they come into Thailand, they're taken to a trafficking camp. They're held against their will in those camps. The families are then extorted for the additional money, etc. If they manage to pay, then they get to resume their journey, come into Malaysia, blend into the informal labor market, and try to earn a living. That has been happening for years. And the only reason that actually that has stopped now is because Thailand, on the 1st and the 4th of May, the Thai authorities discovered those terrible trafficking camps with the 30 dead bodies and etc. So influx, well, you know, it's been happening for a long time, and the movement has been happening for a long time. So it's not really an influx. It's almost like a steady stream of migration. And we must remember that the migration ends in Malaysia because there is a market in Malaysia. There are jobs to be filled in Malaysia, the so-called DDD jobs, that dirty, dangerous, and dull, that Malaysians will not do. And labor needs to be provided. So these people provide the labor. So we benefit from the fruits of their labor. We must protect them while they're doing it. The other concern is the concern of national security. And national security is a concern, but national security is a concern because there is an ongoing and protracted situation of masses of people being denied their basic human rights to live in their own country as citizens. That is a question of human security, a matter of national security for them and for ASEAN, actually. So let's not look at it as national security. Our national security is being threatened because foreigners are coming to our shores. Our national security is being threatened because you have a situation of mass violations of human rights right at our doorstep.
And going back then to the root of the problem, I guess, some would argue, the government of Myanmar, how does it justify its actions against this particular group of people? Because, you know, if the persecution did not occur, you could reasonably say then that you wouldn't find people adrift at sea or in these camps.
You know, it was as far back as 1977, I think, when they first promulgated nationality law that excluded native-born Burmese. And it was on the basis, I believe, of religion. So there were Malay ethnic groups in Myanmar who were denied nationality. The Rohingya were denied nationality. The Chinese Muslims were denied nationality. And then there was another promulgation of citizenship law in 1982, which then as well again denied the Rohingya their nationality. That was the root cause of the problem. And then whenever a new Nationality Act was passed, it what occurred was a sort of a crackdown on foreigners. And when that crackdown occurred, it was always bloody. It involved expulsion of people into the neighboring country. And, you know, so all of that occurred. And this has occurred over many, many years. When that happens over many, many years, the people who are recognized as citizens in that country start to believe that the people who have been denied nationality are truly not nationals. And now, under international law, you really need to look at the human rights standard, and that is, you know, I am native born. I was born here. My forefathers were born here. I have a right to live here, and you as a state must protect me. How did it happen? It's simply a racist approach to population management. Unfortunate, but it occurred. And now, very, very many years later, we're seeing the results, the ongoing results of it, which is really atrocious.
But it's a regional tragedy, and the Rohingya have really been a football being kicked back and forth, and it goes back to colonial times, when, you know, and it's about that retelling of history. Where did they come from, and how did they end up being here? And as you say, it's really now, most of the citizens or most of the people in Myanmar do not consider them to be citizens, and therefore, and each of these, even in the 70s, there were pogroms pushing them back over the border, thereby unseating them and their claim to the land that they'd lived on. And even now, their land and their property is being taken away, their freedom of movement is curtailed, so they're not allowed to move, which just, you know, further inhibits their, I mean, human security, their personal security, their being, you know.
And I think, Lynn, perhaps it's also worth mentioning that since 2012, they have been even further persecuted, if that is at all possible, because they have been confined to a designated area, a particular area, and a few of them live on the outskirts of that area. And that area is considered a sort of a national security zone. No one can enter that area, and they are not allowed to leave that area, to the extent that if you have a child and your child is extremely sick and about to die, you cannot take your child to the hospital, and a doctor cannot enter that area to treat your child. So it is basically genocide that is occurring. And it is there is a growing body of opinion by academics, by as well the ASEAN parliamentarians for human rights have put across a very, very strong report that does suggest that what the Rohingya are experiencing, especially after 2012, amounts to genocide.
So with words like genocide, with words like apartheid being used in the context of the situation, why is the international community not more outraged then? I mean, you would assume that that kind of outrage should be ever present. I mean, it kind of bursts out from time to time. And yet you would hope that it would be, I guess, more constant, more consistent. You know, how can Myanmar be made accountable for these sorts of actions?
Sadly, the Rohingya have not had a champion. They've not had a champion internationally, and especially in the West, where those sorts of debates are happening, where the Palestinians, for instance, have had champions and have had their voices heard. The Rohingya have remained invisible and unheard. Their voices have not been heard. Arguably, also in the diaspora, they have not been able to organize themselves as well as other refugee groups, and therefore have had a more difficult experience of being in the diaspora and of not being able to help those who are left behind in Myanmar and in the refugee camps in Bangladesh. And no champion has been able to be identified who could take it to the UN, who could take it to other national governments with authority.
Yeah, and I think in terms of global outrage, you know, if we just cast our eyes over what's happening throughout the globe in terms of conflict and wars and human rights violations, there's look at Syria, look at Iraq, look at Chad. You know, I mean, the violations are
innumerable.
Almost beyond our ken. You know, so. So yes, the Rohingya is just one more of these terrible violations that are going on around the world.
Gerhard, Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott, you know, while we're talking about international reactions, he responded to questions of whether Australia would resettle any of the 8,000 Rohingyas with nope, nope, nope. Is this a reaction that surprises you?
Not at all. It's absolutely consistent with Tony Abbott's approach to the other boat crisis, which were boats coming from Indonesia and Sri Lanka to Australia. The current government has taken a very, very firm stance on any irregular arrival. The only arrivals still allowed are by plane. And it's garnered him a lot of support domestically. And this is where we come back to, well, how do these things play out domestically? Refugees don't vote unless or until they become citizens. And ironically, a lot of them vote for right-wing parties once they do. But I think they continue to be the football of domestic politics in a lot of these countries because they don't have a voice. They don't have anyone to speak in authority for them or for them to speak themselves. And that's a huge issue. And so, no, that does not surprise me, unfortunately.
Australia is also often portrayed in the media as welcoming to migrants but hostile towards boat people. Would you say that that's a fair characterization of the Australian experience and reaction towards outsiders, I suppose?
Absolutely. Australia has a migration program that allows in about 200,000 people a year. Resettled refugees amount to about 13,000 of those 200,000. And the majority are people who are supposed to come to Australia to help Australia become better economically, largely, not just better as a better nation, but, you know, support Australia with jobs that we can't find Australians for. So the economy is the prime driver there. And boat people is an interesting aspect. Somebody, Ghassan Haj, has written about this, and his take is Australians, especially white Australians, are very worried about boats arriving on the sky, you know, coming towards Australia, because they know that the Australian continent can be invaded by parties coming on boats. It's happened before. They're still in charge. They don't want somebody else to come. So there's a psychological thing about boats arriving, and they don't want that to happen. There's also this issue of not knowing who may be on that boat. Whereas plane arrivals have visas, they are known to the authorities. There are lots of, underlying racism is another issue. And very clearly the people arriving by boat are predominantly of a certain religion, predominantly of a certain color of their skin. That also has a role to play, an underlying racism of the other, of foreignness, that is still quite prevalent in Australia.
So going back then to what we were talking about, you know, right at the start of the interview, that notion of resettlement, because if you're not going to welcome them, then obviously you're hoping that it will be someone else's problem. And that seems to be, you know, it's a case of passing the buck. So Malaysia, Indonesia and Thailand all insist that the international community must resettle or repatriate the migrants within a year. So whose responsibility is it then? I mean, if everybody is saying, look, this needs to be done, the international community, that's such a nebulous phrase.
Yeah, it is. And let's just look at the global picture. You know, again, I want to draw attention again to all the conflicts and wars that are going on around the world, which has led to forced displacement of millions and millions of human beings. I think in mid-2014, there was something like 17 million refugees and 50-something million forcibly displaced persons. Let's just look at the global picture. These people are displaced to other countries. Look at the countries that are sheltering most of the forced migrants around the world. You have Pakistan, you have Lebanon, you have Kenya, you have Jordan, you know, and this is where people are going because that's the closest safe state to get to. And countries are struggling. The international community is struggling. It takes a lot of money, a lot of dollars to keep people safe in the refugee experience. And for us in this region, to insist on the resettlement of 8,000 people when there are tens of millions around the world in need of protection, I think we really need to ask ourselves the question, do we really need to do that, or can we admit them? And I think we can admit them.
What conditions then would come or should come with keeping our borders open to receive those who are fleeing from persecution, who are fleeing from untenable situations?
You know, it's what is needed is a clear framework of response. You know, a clear framework of response is extremely important, because that framework then allows people to enter in an orderly manner. It allows then the national authorities to register people, so you know exactly who's in your territory. At the moment, it has been said that there could be up to 5 million undocumented persons, irregular migrants, whatever term you wish to use, in our country right now. And I would suggest to the national security authorities that really you don't know who they are. And the reason you don't know who they are is because you don't have a framework of response. So if you have a framework of response that includes registration, you will know who people are. If you put them through a proper status determination procedure, national status determination procedure, then you would then also be able to identify those people who perhaps for international criminal law reasons you may not wish to have in your country. And there is a methodology to respond to that as well. At the moment, you really don't know who's in your country. And the reason you don't know is because you don't have a legal framework of response.
I think a lot of regional countries have been quite happy with the being able to approach any of these crises in a case-by-case way. Now, if there was a framework with protocols, they would have to respond in that way, in a certain way. And as I mentioned earlier, the Bali process, Jakarta Declaration, all these declarations, all these times, countries have come together in the region and said, yes, we should have these policies and protocols. But they've never sat down to actually,
go from should to have.
And part of the reason, I think, is because it gives them more leeway to respond how they want in a case by case, rather than a universal way.
Mm. Yeah, but if it's difficult for a newly industrializing country to sign on to the Refugee Convention, because some of the burdens, some of the obligations there are quite burdensome. But an administrative framework. Let's think about putting in place an administrative framework that can respond to this informal labor migration, and within that, you would be able to then identify those people in need of international protection who probably cannot return, those who could return. If you have large numbers of persons from one particular area of origin, and there is a certain push factor, as a regional body, ASEAN, respond to that to stop the push factor. There's so much that can be done, and can be done also within the context of preserving national interests. That can be done. I also want to say something a little bit about the Sustainable Development Goals. And that's, of course, the next phase of the MDGs, right? And their development indicators for all countries. And I would say, I would suggest that an important development indicator should be how we respond to people in need of international protection, to also how we respond to labor migrants, how we respond to, because in our country, if you have up to 5 million people who are irregular migrants for whatever reason, whether or not they're able to return to their own countries, 5 million people can affect how we are able to provide and meet the indicators, respond to the indicators under the SDGs, for instance.
And I think it really starts with very small steps. And a very small step would be to agree on a protocol on what to do with boats in distress in your territorial borders or international borders outside of your territorial borders. That would be a very small first step, but a very important one considering the current crisis.
And unfortunately, that's all the time that we've got to cope with what is really a very complicated issue and very complex one. But anyway, thank you very much for your time. I've been speaking with Dr. Gerhard Hofstetter, a Senior Research Fellow at the University of Queensland, and Sumitra Viswanathan, spokesperson for the Migration Working Group. We've been discussing the ongoing ASEAN refugee crisis. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, PFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.